This is the takeaway for Friday, May 20th, 2016.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The first debris, the first tangible pieces of the puzzle of EgyptAir Flight 804 from Paris to Cairo have begun to surface in the Mediterranean. The flight went down while cruising at 37,000 feet. Its abrupt failure and fall into the sea is consistent with foul play, and Egyptian authorities are being uncharacteristically candid about all this. But nothing has yet been confirmed. There's been no official claim of responsibility. ISIS has been skirmishing along the border and in the Sinai Desert with Egyptian troops for months now, and ISIS technically claims much of Egyptian territory as part of its so-called caliphate. Is this tragedy a sign of just how vulnerable Egypt's national airline and therefore its vital tourism industry is? The questions, of course, are too early for the grief-stricken families of the 66 dead from Flight 804. They are crucial to assessing the threats ahead, though. Miles O'Brien covers aviation as the science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. He says in this case, the fact that EgyptAir is wholly owned by the Egyptian government makes it difficult to decipher its response to this tragedy.
When you have flag carriers, that is, national airlines owned by the government, investigated by another arm of the government, there is an inherent conflict of interest there. And that's something that in the United States we've managed to carve out an independent body, the National Transportation Safety Board, which owes no allegiances to the airlines themselves. And that's why we get honest and forthright accident reports. It's not the same in these countries, and it's something to watch.
And financially, the EgyptAir enterprise is bleeding from a terrible couple of years. The tourism industry is way down in Egypt, and EgyptAir seems to be taking the brunt of that. What are the numbers, if you could tell me?
Well, I don't know the numbers off the top, but it's a grim picture for EgyptAir. The terror problem has pretty much wiped out the tourism industry there. So passenger loads are down. And any time an airline is stressed financially, that's when the regulators really need to pay attention, because when you start cutting corners, it is a very slippery slope. Is it the maintenance they cut corners on? Is it the number of baggage handlers? Or is it, worst case scenario, are they cutting corners on security?
What are the issues here in this particular flight, where it originated and the fact that it took off from France? What are the points of vulnerability on the trajectory and flight plan of this EgyptAir flight?
Well, there are four other cities potentially in the mix besides Paris. That's where the plane stopped in the midst of its duty day. So it's a little bigger picture when you look at possible places that a device, for example, could have been placed on the aircraft, if we're assuming it occurred at the hand of one of the ramp workers or a caterer or something like that. But I think the important point we should all take away from this is whether it's Charles de Gaulle or an airport in Tunis or in Cairo, or for that matter, Atlanta-Hartsfield Airport, the back door of these airports, the part of the airport you don't see, is a huge, huge vulnerability. And we need to pay more attention to it. Maybe a little less effort on the front door, where we're going through and taking off our shoes and pouring out our water in what amounts to a little bit of security theater.
Let's talk about that for a moment. I mean, this is a week when the TSA delays in the U.S. airports have been particularly scandalous. Do you think there's a tension and overinvestment in that front end security and lack of observation of other parts of the whole supply chain?
Absolutely. I think we're putting way too much money on the front door and at the expense of the back door. I'm not saying we shouldn't have a secure way for passengers to be screened, but if it comes at the expense of monitoring what is happening on the ramp, we're making a big mistake. That's the Achilles heel. I mean, we've seen gun running operations operating out of Atlanta-Hartsfield Airport. Drugs get on planes. If a determined worker wants to put a device on an aircraft, it's hard to say there is much in the way of stopping them. I'm not saying that people aren't watching on these ramps, but it's not like we have the level of security that the passengers endure at the front end.
Finally, the debris that they're finding, how is that going to be fit into the puzzle of what happened to this plane?
Well, initially, the debris can tell you a lot, depending on how it fails. Did it bend outward, and is there residue on it indicating an explosion? Or did it fail like bending a paperclip back and forth numerous times? That would indicate something as it fell aerodynamically. Or is it more kind of a blunt trauma kind of thing, impact on the water? That's important. Also, the location of the debris, when you reverse engineer the debris with the currents in the Mediterranean, will take you to the site of the wreckage, we hope. And that's the key, because that's where the black boxes are and that's where the real answers lie.
Miles O'Brien, science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Thanks so much, Miles.
You're welcome, John.
We turn now to Lise Doucette, chief international correspondent for the BBC. Welcome back, Lise.
Oh, very good to be here with you and here with you in person.
Yes, indeed. Although an unfortunate occasion, to be sure, the plane reportedly fell from 37,000 feet to 15,000 feet. It's a way of clumsily suggesting that Egypt itself has fallen so far from what we were talking about just a few years ago, and appears to be in a very unsustainable situation. How would you assess what's going on in Egypt right now?
Egypt is in a tragic downward spiral, and yet there had been some little glimmers of hope recently, John. The Russians, who canceled all their flights, huge tourism earner for Egypt, that all stopped after the downing of a Russian charter plane over the Sinai last year. Egypt took a very long time to admit that that was an act of terrorism. But recently, Vladimir Putin indicated he may be willing to start resuming the Russian flights. So there were some more positive stories about Egypt. And then this happens.
There's been the suggestion that because it's a national airline, a flag carrier, it makes it more difficult to be candid about what's going on for Egypt Air. And although you get the sense that their response to this disaster indicates that they understand the seriousness of the situation, both in this incident and broadly, as you've said. Do you agree with that?
Yes, it's interesting. This is the third major airline incident that Egypt has had to deal with over the past year. But this time, even before there was much evidence, the aviation minister came quickly and said it is more likely to have been an act of terrorism than a technical fault. And people said, oh, before you even know. But they had enough to sort of try to seize the initiative. It is in stark contrast to how they dealt with the Russian airliner incident and were under much criticism.
And because this is a national airline, somewhere in that messaging, mixed or not, is the government, which appears to be also understanding that these are desperate times for Egypt.
Well, for the moment, it's desperate times for the families of the passengers, of the pilots. They will now want more answers about what exactly happened. If it was an act of terrorism, how was it carried out? So that's one thing. That's what the government has to deal with, first of all, its own people. Then the big question will be, where was the weak point? The last stop was Charles de Gaulle Airport. The French authorities say they swept the plane. Well, how closely did they sweep the plane? The Egyptians, of course, have said, well, excuse me, this wasn't us this time. France also has to answer some questions. So there may be more than one place to look for responsibility.
And also a moment for the region. I mean, there's no confirmation that this is a terrorist attack, and there's been no claim of responsibility. But it occurs to me to ask this question. I mean, ISIS claims the Egyptian territory as part of its caliphate, even though, you know, it's not in Egypt. Is Egypt a huge prize in this ISIS battle that we focus on in Syria and Iraq so much?
Well, all of the territory, as you say, is a huge prize because the caliphate, as they call it, has no borders. You know, the experts in these groups have found it rather mysterious, or at least they're questioning, why hasn't there been a claim of responsibility? There doesn't seem to have been what they call chatter among some of these jihadi or Islamist groups in the run-up to this, as there was before the downing of the Russian plane over Sinai last year. We still really don't know. We're in the realm of speculation. All we have is this affirmation by the Egyptians, by most Western intelligence officials, it was more likely to have been terrorism, but that still is not confirmed. And, you know, to the other part of your question, you know, Egypt, of course, is very much squeezed on all sides. I saw President Sisi last year, just before he was going to London, and he said, we warned the West about the rise of the so-called Islamic State in Syria. They didn't listen to us. He said, I'm going to London now to tell David Cameron, you've got to do something about Libya. Now, of course, the leaders in the regions have some questions to be asked of them as well. But we don't seem to be very good at, first of all, understanding what's happening and then putting the resources in place. in order to deal with it.
Finally, how much would you say the people of Egypt are suffering in this situation? And in civil libertarian terms, the Sisi government is not exactly a winner of any United Nations prizes. But how much does the West need the Sisi government to preserve stability in Egypt right now?
Think about Egypt. Just step back from the politics of this. Step back from, yes, the rising concern that this government now, headed by a former military ruler and elected president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, is now more authoritarian than President Hosni Mubarak, who was removed 5 years ago. And you'll remember, John, what a euphoric time that was in the region, no matter what side you were on, because it was a peaceful removal of an authoritarian regime. But fast forward, what has happened in Egypt over the past 5 years is absolutely, you know, dizzying, completely incomprehensible in the sense of where they have arrived 5 years on. And yes, think about the Egyptians. You see the photographs coming from Sharm el-Sheikh, other Egyptian resorts. This is the lifeblood of the Egyptian economy. Restaurants are closing, hotels are closing. There's so many people from at the top of the system to the bottom who depend on this industry. You have to think about them and how they are suffering. But yes, there are big questions about the crackdown on civil liberties. More than about 150 young people were given between 2 and 5 years sentence for going out and protesting against the fact that Egypt gave away two of its islands to the Saudi monarchy because, of course, the Saudis are writing the big checks for Egypt to help it through these economic problems. The United States, last year, President Obama, he resumed the military aid that had been suspended after the 2013 ousting of the elected Muslim Brotherhood government. And we are back to where we were when Condoleezza Rice, when she was the American Secretary of State, went to Cairo and said, we have been struggling to achieve either democracy or stability. And as a result of our choices, we achieved neither. And yet again, people are saying, why is President Obama, why are Western leaders, why are leaders in the region supporting President Sisi when he is an affront to democracy? Because they need President Sisi. They need him in the fight against the so-called Islamic State. John Kerry was just there recently to talk about Egypt again resuming its role in the Israeli-Palestinian talks, in playing a big role in the battle in Libya. So this is where we are yet again. But these same issues keep coming back to the region. And when they come back, they are even more terrifying, more complex, and more difficult to tackle than they were before.
Sobering issues to contemplate as part of the aftermath of this plane disaster, Egypt Air Flight 804. Lee Stussett, Chief International Correspondent for the BBC, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John. Really good to be here.
Hate to bring up a sensitive subject, but are you able to retire? Have you saved enough?
This is Ted calling from Freehold, New Jersey. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to retire. So the answer is never. I'm going to have to work until I drop.
Record number of Americans are working past the age of 65. It's something we're going to be talking about in the coming weeks, and we want your story. Go to thetakeaway.org/retirement right now to sign up, and a producer from our team will contact you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, working to advance cutting-edge research and cures and committed to helping to make someday today for thousands of blood cancer patients. Learn more at lls.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Well, they weren't exactly whistling while they were working on the floor of the House of Representatives yesterday. Sounds like the third quarter of a New York Knicks game. The booze and hissing comes from lawmakers who weren't happy about an amendment that would have removed an anti-discrimination provision that was intended to protect members of the LGBT community working for the federal government. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick was there. Todd, what's the significance of this battle?
Oh, boy, it was chaos, John. You played a little bit of it there. We're going to go back to 2014 for the start of this story on LGBT discrimination in the federal government. But let me bring you a little bit more chaos from the House floor. Listen to Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer after this went down.
Mr. Speaker, let me raise another parliamentary inquiry. Mr. Speaker, let me raise a parliamentary inquiry. Mr. Speaker,
the chair will put them in.
Mr. Speaker.
Was this a game playing, parliamentary game playing, a secret amendment kind of thing?
It was a lot of that. There was some chicanery, some procedural insiderness, and a lot of arm twisting on the House floor. Here's what this was about, John. They're debating a military construction spending bill. Now, back in 2014, people might remember President Obama issued an executive order that said, if you're a government contractor doing military contracts or other business with the federal government, we're going to check. You cannot discriminate against LGBT employees. You can't fire them for being gay. You can't punish them for being gay. And if you have a record of doing it, you can't get that federal contract. Executive order from the White House. There was an amendment slipped into this military construction bill, however, in committee, and then again using procedural tricks in the Rules Committee that are a little bit down in the weeds, that undid this executive order using religious freedom grounds. It was put in there by Republicans, and it would have undone President Obama's executive order. Well, along came an amendment in the bill yesterday that would have undid the undoing. It would have kept President Obama's executive order protecting LGBT employees at federal contractors in the bill. Now, here's the thing, John. It passed. It was set to pass by 11 votes. When the votes were counted, 217 to 206, with plenty of Republican support, or at least a few Republicans, and that surprised a lot of people. The clock runs down. You know, they have a countdown clock on these votes. They don't always stick to it, but the clock ran down, and the thing was getting ready to pass by 11 votes, except the gavel never dropped. And that's when the arm twisting started to switch those votes. And that's when you heard at the top there, John, in the end, that vote failed, 212 to 213. And it's when the Republican whips went to Republican members, twisted their arms on the House floor, got them to change their votes. Then the gavel was dropped, and then that amendment went down. Here was Steny Hoyer, the Democratic whip, right after that happened.
If we had done to the Republicans what was done to us, what was done to switch votes so that discrimination could prevail, there would be outrage expressed long into the night from our Republican colleagues.
So where does it stand now? I mean, is this symbolic because the Senate won't even touch it?
No, this amendment is defeated, and so that military construction bill passed, and it passed with a provision that basically protects federal contractors to keep their policies if they can justify them on very broad religious freedom grounds that are, frankly, not very well defined in the language of the law, certainly open to a court challenge. Now, the Senate has not done this bill yet, so you're right, it could get undone there, but we'll have to see what happens. It is certainly unsettled. Now, you want to know about Republicans, of course. Here was the thing. This all went down so fast on the House floor that it was hard to tell who switched their votes. You couldn't really find them afterward. They included people, by the way, like Greg Walden from Oregon, who's the head of the Republicans' campaign committee. People like Daryl Issa, who from California, who you've seen on TV lots of times, the former chairman of the House Oversight Committee for Republicans. They were a little bit hard to find after this went down. They were ones who first voted to back President Obama on LGBT discrimination and then switched their votes. Here's Republican Jeff Sessions. He's chairman of the Rules Committee.
First of all, let me state this. I am a Republican. We do not discriminate.
But what does that mean?
He means that they opposed this amendment on procedural grounds that were about slipping an amendment that was not germane into the right kind of bill, that the issue had already been dealt with, that it really didn't have anything with discrimination per se. This happens sometimes on tough votes, John, on the House and Senate floor, where you can either use substance or use procedure. But Democrats weren't having this. Sean Patrick Maloney is from Poughkeepsie, New York, in the Hudson River Valley. He was sponsor of the amendment that was first up by 11 votes and then defeated by one vote after the gavel dropped, after the vote was held open. Here's Sean Patrick Maloney talking about what happened when Republican whip Kevin McCarthy was twisting arms of his fellow Republicans on this vote.
Sure, I went over and I told him. I said, Kevin, you can do this. You don't have to twist people's arms. And he told me to get back on my own side. And I said, what side am I supposed to stand on to support equality? You know, your own members are voting for this bill. It's not me doing it. It's your members.
All right. So I'm a member of the LGBT community this morning or today or this week. Do I feel better or worse about what went on Capitol Hill?
Gosh, John, I don't know. I suppose you feel a bit worse because if this military construction bill passes as is, federal contractors will still legally be able to discriminate against LGBT people. You might feel good, on the other hand, that it's gotten so much attention and that maybe the glare of media attention and Capitol Hill reporters watching this chaos go down has brought plenty of attention to it. I'll leave you once again. Maybe you would be comforted if you were that person with the words of Sean Patrick Maloney.
These are members of his own caucus who supported this and who wanted to support equality. And the leader went around and twisted their arms, and they voted for discrimination. And the members who switched are going to hold a very special place in American history as people who didn't have the guts to stand up and support the will of the House.
Well, we'll see where this goes next. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. It's Friday, and we have our princess of the platforms, our fabulous Belle of the Binge Watchers herself, because in a world where you can watch every episode of everything that's ever been produced anytime you want, or listen to all the music that's ever been recorded, there's no such thing anymore as wasted time. Melissa Lockhart writes for The Guardian and Time, but she saves the best of herself for us.
If you don't know what to watch or listen to this weekend, I've got you covered. Two stops in the time machine today, and the first stop is 1963. Everyone loves movies about the presidency, and everyone loves Bryan Cranston, who of course is best known for playing Walter White on Breaking Bad.
Say my name, Eisenberg.
But a new role puts him about as far as possible from being a meth kingpin. It puts him in the White House.
I'm coming for you, Dick. Now, I love you more than my own daddy. But if you get in my way, I'll crush you.
All right, so maybe the characters aren't so different after all. But in the HBO adaptation of All the Way, Cranston steps into the shoes of President Johnson. The film focuses on Johnson's first year in office, where he's confronting the escalation of the war in Vietnam, the civil rights issues at home, all while campaigning against Barry Goldwater in the 1964 election.
We're going to declare a war on poverty.
A war on poverty?
That's right. Now, I got all kinds of federal programs in mind on health, education, literacy, jobs, you name it. We're going to change this country top to bottom.
Not only does Cranston sound like Johnson, but director Jay Roach went all out to achieve LBJ's look, creating prosthetics for Cranston's nose and ears. And Cranston knows the character well. He played the part on Broadway in Robert Schenken's play of the same name. Note to future Barack Obama impersonators, cut your teeth on live stage first. It really makes a difference. Check out the first few minutes of the film, where there's a moment where Cranston looks around the Oval Office and the weight of the presidency settles on him. It is beautiful and heartbreaking, all thanks to Cranston's acting.
Where were you just now, Mr. President?
Accidental president. That's what they'll say.
It's not a one-man show, though. The cast is incredible, particularly the work done by Anthony Mackie, who was last seen playing Falcon in Captain America: Civil War. But this time he's playing Martin Luther King Jr. Cranston won a Tony for his performance in the Broadway version, and it would not be a surprise if he is nominated for an Emmy for his work in this film. You can catch the premiere of All the Way this Saturday at 8 p.m. on HBO. All right, now let's fast forward from 1963 to 1978, the year that the Cars signed to Elektra Records. The group rose to fame in the early 1980s, but unlike some of the bands in the Boston scene, like Mission to Burma or the Del Fuegos, the Cars found a lot of mainstream fame with their new wave pop hits. Songs like Just What I Needed and Magic, and my personal favorite, Since You're Gone.
Since you're gone.
The cars have a new box set that may have slipped under the radar. It's called the Electra Years, and it features all the classics. It's the perfect soundtrack to a springtime dance party. Whether you're dancing in your living room, listening to Drive in your car, or in line at the grocery store, you're just going to want to crank it up. Or, you know, shake it up. Got a tip for me? Something wild and wacky you're seeing out there? Leave us a comment on thetakeaway.org. Shake it up. I'm Melissa Locker, reporting for The Takeaway. Dance all night, get real loose. You don't need no bad excuse. Dance all night with anyone. Don't let nobody pick your phone. Shake it up. Shake it up.
I'll have what she's having.
You guys up for a toga party?
Toga!
The word itself makes some men uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah?
Living on your own definitely has its perks.
Shrink, I know so very little about you.
I know very little about you.
Could you send up some champagne and strawberries, please?
Of course.
Well, where are the strawberries, Rafer? Rafer Guzman is here, film critic for Newsday and our film critic here on The Takeaway, because it's Friday. So... How you feeling?
You want me to just launch into it?
Yeah. Hell yeah. No, actually, the first movie you have here, I cannot believe that you're doing. Is it really titled Wiener?
Yes, it is.
This is the worst. Doing a documentary on my scandal.
Hi.
What is that?
I mean, it's the documentary on Anthony Wiener. What else could it be called? You know, the filmmaker had to get in there first because you knew that anybody else who made a movie about him would have to call it Wiener. Now he's staked his claim. You remember Anthony Wiener,
sure.
Mayoral
okay.
candidate, you
Absolutely.
Know, the sexting
yep.
scandal.
Yep.
This movie was supposed to be the chronicle of his comeback, which looked very promising for a while until more of those pictures surfaced and the whole thing went into the tank.
As they were filming.
As they were filming, yes, right, yeah, in the middle of it. Amazingly, Wiener does not shut the production down, and in fact, he lets the filmmaker, is a former aide, a former staffer to Wiener, years before the scandal broke, he lets these people into absolutely every facet of his life and his campaign, and it is extraordinary.
Really?
You get to see... the kinds of things you never thought you'd be allowed to see. You get to see him rehearsing his truth-stretching strategies with his public relations officer. You get to see him rehearsing his apology speech. You get to sit in while he's watching his campaign just go straight into the toilet on television, and his wife is in the background simmering. I mean, you
Who
cannot
is the,
believe.
A huge deal in the Clinton campaign right now.
That's right. You know, for all the access that Anthony Wiener gives these filmmakers, and it's unprecedented. Huma Abedin, his wife, remains a bit of a mystery in this. I think a lot of people have analyzed her to death in the media. We still don't really know
right.
her. I think the filmmakers just maybe didn't feel comfortable poking that camera in her face and grilling her. They let her go a little bit. But you
Why?
See everything.
Why did Wiener do this? I guess at that point, when everything's falling apart, he just calculated, at least I can make a couple of people happy, the filmmakers.
I think Anthony Wiener comes across as a guy who just absolutely will not shrink from public view, perhaps to his detriment, perhaps to ours. But you kind of have to admire a guy who can go through all this and just keep walking the streets and kissing babies and showing up to the West Indian Day Parade in a Guayabera, shaking his tail feathers. I mean, he just will not quit. It's pretty impressive.
Do I have to admire him?
You don't have
to
admire him, but I will tell you, this is the political documentary I have been waiting to see
really?
My whole life. It's just fascinating.
Fantastic. All right. So number two here is The Nice Guys.
Did you fall down the hill?
I had like three drinks tops.
Yeah, that's why you can't walk straight.
Oh, excuse me. I'm carrying dead bodies. I'm sorry. I'm not Kishnerov.
You can't even say Baryshnikov. You did, didn't you? You fell down the hill. You get drunk. You lose your gun. You take your header off the balcony, and now you're going to tell me it's like a hallowed time on a detective ploy, right?
It was very slippery up there, okay? I was in the pool.
All right, so this is Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe trying to do the Danny Glover, Mel Gibson pairing, you think?
A little bit like more like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which was by Shane Black with Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer. This is Shane Black's kind of follow-up to that. 1970s Los Angeles, two detectives, mismatched, investigating the death of a porn star. I think this movie wants to be kind of a rough-and-tumble, saucy, you know, breezy action comedy. I just think the problem is that Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe, these are not comedic timing kind of guys. They're these very intense actors. They're not great at sharing the screen. I often feel like they're kind of acting in tandem, but they're not really with each other. It's an enjoyable movie. It's fun. Shane Black's a great director. It's zippy and it has its moments. It's not the kind of comic gold that you're really expecting.
Zippy and has its moments. Angry Birds?
Remember, the goal is the castle. Get to the castle. Who wants to go first?
Over here.
I do.
Me.
Hey, all right, Matilda.
Always a bridesmaid.
Step right up. Keep your wings, legs, and feet inside the slingshot.
Shoot
at all
it.
Times.
Okie doke.
Fire!
I think all my kids are too old to want to go see this. I'm hoping, but what do you think?
Well, lucky you. I think, you know, I will have to say I expected very little from an animated film based on a video game app. It does all right. I don't think it makes a lot of sense if you haven't played the game. You might be wondering why the birds are flightless and where that giant slingshot came from. But of course, if you're 4 years old, you know, you don't ask questions like that and you'll enjoy it. I guess the one thing I would say about this movie is I was kind of glad to see that anger is being extolled as a virtue in a children's film. You know, the hero,
good,
Red.
Finally.
You know, yeah. Jason Sudeikis plays Red. And I kind of thought that was sort of, you know, a little bit of a twist on the genre.
Well, the anger stole the movie Inside Out, that's for sure.
That's right. All sadness was the heroine of that.
That's right. Number four, Sorority Rising.
They don't understand the most important rule of sisterhood. There's no I in sorority.
Yeah, there is. There's two, actually.
There's just one.
No, that's a Y.
No, in the middle.
That's an O.
Two I's straddling the Y. S-O-R-R-I-A-Y-O-R-I-T-Y.
What?
There's a U in there that you guys are all missing.
Yes, Neighbors 2, this is the sorority that moves in next door, not the fraternity that moves in next door. It had to be a sequel, right?
That's right. And where else could they really go with that sequel?
Right.
Chloe Grace Moretz is the leader of the Kappa News. I like the fact that this film actually has kind of an empowerment message. One reason that the sorority moves in next door is because they're not allowed to have their own parties on campus. And so they feel like they should have the same rights as the guys and that they should be just as rowdy and freewheeling and chaotic. There are none of the writers of this film, five different writers, none of them are women. And I think it kind of shows in the movie. The sorority girls don't quite feel like real people to me. I know that's kind of a lot to ask from a comedy like this, but they don't really come across the way that Zac Efron did in the first one. And I think if they'd had a woman in that writer's room, it might have been a better film.
So Angry Birds and Wiener are probably your top two.
Surprisingly enough, John, I know your feelings about Anthony Wiener, but I'm telling you that movie will knock your socks off.
All right, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, with some stuff to do this weekend. Wiener, The Nice Guys, Angry Birds, and Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising. Hey, you have a great weekend, Rafer.
You too, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
So you're looking for a gig? Here's a gig. I mean, imagine if one day you get a call. Hello? Hello? Oh, for heaven's sakes. For heaven's sakes, right? It's His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Let me put this on speaker. What did you say you want to share?
Everybody, this is the rushing, making money. And we believe if you have money, all problems can solve. That's wrong. Money important, but at the same time, there's no point to neglect about our inner values. That's very important.
Inner values. Well, sounds good, but why are you telling me this, Your Holiness?
Pay more attention about our inner ability in order to achieve calm mind.
Yes, we must achieve a calm mind.
When we face these things, instead of solving through using force, not that kind of response, but how to solve these differences through dialogue.
Ah, okay. Here's a suggestion. How about I come up with some kind of a map of the emotional states of human beings to help them find their way to this inner peace, something like an atlas. Look, I like it. I'll get started right away. And you know, this imagined conversation actually happened between His Holiness and Dr. Paul Ekman, a veteran psychologist, professor emeritus at the University of California, San Francisco. Ekman has been studying people's emotions as a scientist for nearly 60 years now. And the Dalai Lama hired Ekman and his daughter Eve to come up with an atlas of emotions, or a map of the mind, to literally help people find their way through their emotions and become more aware of their inner selves. More than 80 million people have visited the website since it went up this month. President Obama is said to be a fan. It's all about emotions, but its goal, of course, I mean, the Dalai Lama, right, is world peace.
Fear, anger, disgust, sadness, enjoyment, contempt, a difficult word for an emotion that I got a lot of evidence for its universality, and surprise. Now, surprise is the only emotion that's hedonically neutral. When you're surprised, it's not clear whether that's a positive or a negative feeling. Depends on what happens afterwards, what was surprising you.
So surprise can lead to fear or enjoyment.
Yes.
Right.
Or boredom.
Or boredom. Do these seven universal emotions behave like axioms, like sort of primary colors, or are they very, very different from that?
They're really very different, very distinct. Earlier in my research, I considered the possibility that they might blend one into another and you might feel two or three at the same moment. That doesn't seem to be the case when you actually look at people's behavior. You could switch from one emotion to another in a fraction of a second, but you don't experience two emotions simultaneously. You may go back and forth between two emotions so quickly that you think you're having a blend, but blends don't really exist in actuality.
Yeah, thinking about that, I think you're right. You know, we blend a lot of things, X amount of this and X amount of that. But you really can't blend emotions. You're either in that state or you're not in that state, which is, I guess, why they're so powerful.
It certainly is one of the reasons. Well, they command and run our behavior for at least a moment or two.
The idea of an atlas of the mind or an atlas of our emotions, our personality, what does that entail?
Well, it entails making us aware of really the complexity of this very intimate part of ourselves. People would like to be able to choose what they feel, when they feel it, and how they act when they have a particular feeling. And emotions don't enable that. The first step, of course, is to become aware of what it is you are feeling. Usually we're not aware of what we're feeling until afterwards or until somebody says, "What are you upset about?" And then we realize, "Oh, I guess I am upset." So awareness isn't a built-in to emotions, in fact, just the opposite. And if we want to have choice, then we have to develop that awareness. And the atlas is, we call it an atlas because it's a collection of four different maps, each map showing you different features of how emotions work.
What did you begin studying that got you on your way to being confident enough to render an atlas of emotions when asked by the Dalai Lama?
My first publication on this topic was in 1957, so I've been at this a long time. I began by looking at stress, but that word doesn't really tell you what is stressing you, so it's too vague a word. It wasn't until the middle 60s that I started thinking and doing research on specific emotions. My focus was on what we could see, and the face is our best tool. We can learn more about how someone is feeling from their face than from a MRI. The beginning of interest in this was when in the late 60s, I got the first fairly robust evidence that at least five, perhaps seven emotions are universal to our species. It doesn't matter where you are, who you're seeing. When someone is feeling fear, you'll see the same display on their face.
Does the Dalai Lama want us to be more objectively aware of our mind and how it works? Or does he, in fact, prefer that we're engaged and integrated with our mind and not maybe watching ourselves as we do and feel things?
Well, he said to me that when we wanted to get to the new world, we needed a map to get there. His belief, and on this I completely agree with him, that by introducing awareness, we introduce choice. And it's only when we're unaware of what we're feeling that we act without choice or consideration in sometimes regrettable ways. If we had a map of our emotions, that might help us get to a more calm state of mind.
If everyone is acting this way, you know, the Dalai Lama would say we're, you know, on our way to world peace. It's a pretty lofty goal.
Why not have lofty goals?
Well said. Dr. Paul Ekman, thank you so much.
Been a pleasure.
Dr. Paul Ekman is a psychologist who helped produce the website Atlas of Emotions. And here's something to take with you today. The CBS journalist and 60 Minutes correspondent Morley Safer, who died this weekend, was my friend. Morley Safer used a map better than any reporter I ever knew. It took him to places no one else would go, but he took us all with him.
It was my wake up with the Marines. I got there, and that afternoon I went around to various Marine command posts, and I went to one, and they said, well, you know, we're going on an operation in the morning. Would you like to come? And I said, sure. About halfway there, one of the officers said, well, we're going to punish this village. They've been harboring people. And then when we got into the village, they just systematically set about destroying it.
Morley Safer, talking about a famous piece that he did for the CBS Evening News in 1965. I keep playing that video of Morley Safer telling the world about the failure of military power and the failure of moral courage that would become America's experience in Vietnam. But of course, for us, it's the triumph of journalism and the triumph of truth over spin. We'll miss you, Morley. That's all for this day and this week. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.